This morning's sermon is going to be quite different than usual. Most Sundays, as you know, I preach through a section of the Bible. That's really what we like to do here more than anything else, is work our way through books of the Bible a section at a time. So if you're visiting with us, understand this is not a typical or normal TPC sermon in any kind of way. But occasionally, I do like to focus on some part of church history. If we are going to navigate the world with wisdom, we have to understand the world in which we live, and that means understanding history, how we got to where we are. It's important for us to know our story. History matters. And over the course of my years here at TPC, I especially like to do history sermons on Reformation Sunday and All Saints Sunday in October and November, but I didn't do that last year, and so you can consider this something of a makeup sermon because this is a history sermon. The sermon this morning is a history lesson. This sermon's also connected to the two talks that I gave at our conference over the weekend, so if you didn't make the conference, that's fine. I think you'll still be able to follow the sermon just as well. But if you were here for the conference and heard me on Friday night and Saturday morning, I think you'll see a lot of connections between what I say this morning and what I did in those two talks. I want to start with a question. When you look at America today, do you ever wonder what went wrong? Where did we as a nation take a wrong turn? I think if you're paying attention to things and you know something about where we came from and where we are now, you have to ask that question. The founding of America was largely Christian, not perfectly Christian. There were certainly many flaws and inconsistencies, but it was largely Christian. And for the first half of our nation's history, the Christian influence remained very strong. Our national character and institutions were largely shaped by the Christian faith. Again, it wasn't perfect by any means, but it was real. The Christian influence on our nation was deep and broad. At our founding, for example, you could say that at our founding, you could say the nation was not just Christian, but it was actually Calvinistic. Not just Christian, but mostly Calvinistic. The Presbyterian Church in particular had a place of national prominence. One historian put it this way, he said, in the early 1800s, the Presbyterian General Assembly was one of the most impressive and powerful bodies in the world. Okay, General Assembly, if you don't know, General Assembly is the name for the annual meeting of Presbyterian leaders where pastors and elders from churches across the nation come together to make decisions for the whole. Okay, Presbyterians have traditionally called that General Assembly. In our denomination, we call it General Council, but it's the same thing. And looking at that period of American history, he says the Presbyterian General Assembly was one of the most impressive and powerful bodies in the world. That same historian goes on to say that at that time, Presbyterian General Assembly had a power rivaling, if not surpassing, that of Congress, affecting not merely the religious, but the civil interests of the nation. Okay, that's what you call an influential church, a church that has cultural influence, even cultural power. Another historian puts it this way. Another historian says, in the early 19th century, the Presbyterian General Assembly rivaled the federal government for popular influence and esteem. Okay, that's pretty amazing to think that the church had that kind of prominence. In the early decades of American history, the decisions of Presbyterian General Assemblies could be front page news. Newspapers would send reporters to cover General Assembly because the decisions made there were of great interest and importance to the nation. And of course, it wasn't just the Presbyterians. I picked them out because they were particularly prominent and also because we stand in that tradition. But that's how things once were. Now, you look at our situation today, obviously those days are long gone. Nobody covers Presbyterian General Assemblies of any Presbyterian denomination, and they certainly don't have that kind of power or influence in the culture. Those days are long gone. What happened? What went wrong? How did the church lose its lofty position of cultural influence in America? Here's another way of asking that question for us, a more specific way of getting at it. What about the South? This region of the nation known affectionately as the Bible Belt, What about the South? We have more Christians than any other region in the country. We have more churches. And yet, that doesn't seem to make as much difference as it should. I'm not saying there are no differences. I'm just saying it doesn't make as much difference as it should. When you consider the sheer number of Christians and churches in our region, why aren't we more different from the rest of the country? The South is definitely distinct from other regions in the country. We are more conservative. We're less progressive. We're more Christian in some fundamental ways. In many ways, the Bible Belt, and you could say along with parts of the Heartland in the Midwest, really is the conscience of the nation today. The Bible Belt has been and continues to be conservative and continues to be a bulwark against progressivism. The South is certainly more heavily churched than any other region. You go into some small southern towns, and it seems like there are as many churches as there are people. Okay, obviously, we live in a region where people still go to church. We live in the most churched metropolitan area in the country here in Birmingham. Okay, of all the larger cities in the entire country, more people go to church on a Sunday in Birmingham than any other city. The South is more generous, it's more philanthropic than other regions. The South is certainly friendlier. I've lived in a lot of different regions of the country, and I can say Southerners are definitely a lot friendlier than other places in our country you could go. The South has preserved manners and etiquette more than other regions. It is a more family-friendly region. It's definitely easier in some ways for Christian parents to raise their children here than in some other parts of the country. I mean, Mayberry was not exactly the New Jerusalem, but it's not Sodom either, and it's certainly not Portland, which might be worse than Sodom. At a time when many are critiquing the Bible Belt, I will happily defend it. I think the Bible Belt, and even if you just say it's a veneer of Christian culture that kind of overlays things, I think that's still good. It's easier to plant churches in this region. It's easier to do evangelism in the Bible Belt than in other places that are more hardened. I think that's clear. And yet again, given the number of professing Christians in the South, it's not nearly as different from other more progressive parts of the country as you might expect. And so while Christian faith continues to make its mark on our region, we still have to ask this question: how can so many Christians make so little difference? In many ways, the South, like the rest of the nation, has been secularized. And so we have to ask, what happened? Where did we go wrong? What wrong turn did we take? Now, there are a lot of angles that we could take if we try to answer that question. History's always complex. It's always complicated. But out of the many complicated factors, I want to pick out one and focus on it because I think it's a net that will capture a lot of what has gone wrong. Not everything, but it captures a lot of what has gone wrong. And I would identify that as revivalism. Revivalism. The two main distortions of the Christian faith that have arisen in American Christianity, you could say conservative American Christianity, are revivalism and dispensationalism. Okay, I didn't mention dispensationalism by name, but when I gave my sermon on Israel a few weeks back, I was implicitly critiquing dispensationalism. When I preached on Israel, the errors I was seeking to correct are errors that have cropped up because of a particular view called dispensationalism. That's one distortion. The other distortion is revivalism, and that's what I want to focus on this morning. Now, you may not be familiar with that word. You might be confused to hear that. You might think, aren't revivals good? Don't we pray for revivals? And if so, how can revivalism be bad? Well, yes, revivals, when they're real, are good, of course. But revivalism is something different. Revivalism is the label historians have put on a rather novel and uniquely American form of Christian faith that arose in our nation's history. See, you really cannot understand changes that have taken place in American history without understanding changes in American theology and in the American church. And revivalism is perhaps the most significant change that has taken place in the life of the church in American history. Its impact is still with us today. the after effects, the residue of revivalism is still very much with us. Revivalism is the most peculiar feature of the American church. It arose early in our history, and it especially imprinted itself on Southern churches and Southern culture. Revivalism arose during the first and especially during the second Great Awakening. And so to understand revivalism, we've really got to go back to the mid-18th century before America was even its own nation. The first Great Awakening arose in the 1730s and lasted for several decades. In fact, it also took place in Britain, and some of the most famous figures in the first Great Awakening preached on both sides of the Atlantic. They preached in Great Britain, they preached in the American colonies. In the first Great Awakening, George Whitefield was the dominant figure, and he's easily one of the greatest preachers in history. He was a Calvinistic Anglican who preached the gospel of grace with great rhetorical force and spiritual power. Whitefield could preach outdoors to as many as 30,000 people at once. He had that kind of voice. He had that strong of a voice. George Whitefield was so influential in the formation of America through his preaching that he's been called the Forgotten Founding Father. We talk about Thomas Jefferson and James Madison and John Adams and John Witherspoon and all these others, but George Whitefield played his role too. Even though he died before America actually declared independence, his preaching was so formative on the colonies, he's been referred to as the Forgotten Founding Father. Whitefield crossed the Atlantic Ocean 8 times on preaching tours. Just to give you a sense of what kind of preacher he was, sometimes when he was crossing the Atlantic, if there was a convoy of ships traveling together, which was common, if there were calm winds, they would occasionally tie the ships together, and Whitefield would preach to all of the crews at once. People were so eager to hear his preaching. Whitefield started an orphanage in Georgia, and he would raise money for the orphanage on his preaching tours. As he traveled around preaching, he would raise money for the orphanage back in Georgia. Ben Franklin, who was not a believer, would often go listen to Whitefield because he was so impressed with Whitefield's oratory. Whitefield's oratory was so remarkable that Franklin never missed an opportunity to hear him preach. And Franklin would always donate to the orphanage afterwards. But one time, Franklin was going to go hear Whitefield, and he decided that he had given enough money to Whitefield's orphanages, and so he was going to leave all his money at home so he wouldn't be tempted to give. Well, after Whitefield preached, Franklin was so moved, he ended up borrowing money from a friend to give to the orphanage anyway. Whitefield just had that kind of effect on people with his preaching. He was undoubtedly one of the greatest evangelists to ever live. And he was a remarkably humble man. You have to keep in mind, he was something of a celebrity. Over time, he became quite famous, but he never started a movement. Toward the end of his life, he said, "Let my name perish, but Christ be glorified. Let my name die, and even my friends forget me, if by that means the cause of Jesus may be promoted." Whitefield's preaching was not very exegetical, but it was very doctrinal. You can actually go read his sermons. Many have been published. You can go read his sermons, and you'll find they're not very exegetical, but they are very doctrinally deep, very doctrinally rich. He preached what Calvinists call the doctrines of grace. He emphasized the depravity of man and the sovereign work of the Holy Spirit to bring men to faith. Other figures in the First Great Awakening include men like John Wesley and Jonathan Edwards. The First Great Awakening was undoubtedly doctrinally solid for the most part. Yes, it had some problems, it had some excesses, some emotional excesses in some cases, but it also had strong theologians like Edwards and Whitefield to rein them in. Edwards, in particular, wrote quite a bit about how to evaluate the revivals. Edwards saw this going on, and Edwards was a part of it, and he wrote an analysis of it, a theological analysis, to help people discern when and where this is a true work of God. As I said on Saturday, it was really the preaching of the First Great Awakening that paved the way for the American War for Independence by laying out a theological case for separation from Britain based on John Calvin's covenantal doctrine of civil government and his teaching on the role of the lesser magistrate to protect the people from tyranny. The First Great Awakening was necessary because many in the church had grown lax. People would still attend church, they still generally lived upright lives, but they were spiritually weak. And so the First Great Awakening was generally good. It was a remedy for this weakness. It elevated and strengthened the faith and the character of the people. But there were a couple of things that happened that were not so good, a couple of features of the First Great Awakening that were problematic. One is that, ironically, the First Great Awakening had the effect of weakening the church as an institution and actually divided churches. So even as Christians are being strengthened in some ways individually, the church is actually being weakened in some ways as an institution. Most of Whitfield's preaching took place not in churches because church buildings weren't big enough to accommodate the crowds, but also because some pastors did not welcome him. Some pastors saw Whitfield and other revivalists as a threat and as a distraction from their own ministry and the work of the local church. Here's one example to kind of give you a sense of how this unfolded. One time, Whitfield offered his services. He offered to preach in a church, and the pastor declined the invitation. When the members of the congregation found out, they locked their pastor in a closet. Okay, don't get any ideas here. They locked their pastor in a closet, and they sent word to Whitfield that he actually was welcome to come and preach. Okay, so you can see why some local pastors were not all that thrilled with this traveling evangelist. You know, that's a funny story. But in some cases, pastors saw real problems developing. There were emotional excesses. There was a tendency to devalue the regular, ordinary ministry of the local church. In the wake of the revivals, people did not value the ordinary Lord's Day worship service in the same way that they had before. They did not value the ordinary Lord's Day liturgy because it wasn't as exciting as an outdoor revival with a famous preacher. You know, where is the real religious action happening? Not in the local church anymore with its liturgy and its preaching by a local pastor and its sacraments. No, the real action is taking place outside the church in the revival meetings. And of course, churches divided over their response to the revival. Some favorable, others not so favorable, some very suspicious of the revivals. And so again, ironically, the First Great Awakening did much to strengthen Christians, but it simultaneously made the church as an institution. It made churches weaker. And that's something that would come back to haunt America, the weakening of the church. The First Great Awakening was doctrinally rigorous, but it chipped away at the central role the local church had always played in the lives of Christians and in the culture. But really, the biggest losers of the First Great Awakening were covenant children. In the 16th and 17th centuries, virtually all of the reformers taught a doctrine of covenant succession. That is, that children born to Christian parents would grow up Christian, that they are loved by God, they're set apart by God, they're to be included in the life of the church, they're to be nurtured in the faith by their parents. And in this way, they would grow up never knowing a day when they did not love and trust the Lord Jesus. They would be trained and discipled and disciplined as Christians. Growing up in the faith, never remembering a day when they did not love and trust Jesus, was considered normal and normative in the Reformed tradition. John Calvin put it this way. He said, God announces that he adopts our infants as his children before they are born, when he promises to be a God to us and our seed after us. This promise includes their salvation. Calvin said, covenant children are set apart from the world by God's covenant promise. I will be a God to you and to your children. In the 17th century, the Westminster Divines, who wrote the Westminster Larger Catechism, said this about covenant children in their Directory for Public Worship. They said, covenant children are Christians and holy even before baptism, and therefore are to be baptized. The Westminster Divines, who gave us the Westminster Confession, looked at covenant children through the lens of the covenant promise. They said, not by nature, but by the grace of God, these children are Christian children and should be raised accordingly. The reformers in the 16th and 17th centuries taught Christian parents to believe the covenant promises for and about their children, to nurture their children in the faith in those promises. But the First Great Awakening was very focused on having a crisis conversion experience. That's how you become a Christian, is through a crisis conversion experience. And that crisis conversion experience replaced covenant nurture even for children born into a Christian home. Okay, it's one thing to say that someone coming from the outside, from a non-Christian, unchurched background, you know, somebody coming from a non-Christian background, it's one thing to say that person needs to have a conversion experience. But in the First Great Awakening, that paradigm began to be applied to covenant children born into Christian homes, and that was novel. That was novel. That was a break with the Reformed tradition. The First Great Awakening was basically over by 1770 when Whitfield died. Obviously, the after effects carried through to the American War for Independence and into the early days of the new nation. So think about this, how deeply Christian the nation was. Okay, not just that a Christian theological case was made for the War for Independence, but at America's founding, when we actually became our own nation, 9 of the 13 colonies had established churches. We didn't have a federally established church, a national church, but 9 of the 13 original colonies had established churches at the state level. Many states had religious test oaths so that only Trinitarian Christians could hold civil office. Our universities at that time were generally solid in the faith. They were places of Christian discipleship and Christian learning. Hard to imagine that now, universities being a Christian place, but it was the case then. We had inherited the British common law tradition, which was deeply influenced by the Bible. So biblical law shaped American law from the start. Our Constitution did not formally declare us to be a Christian nation, but informally, we were definitely Christian. The character of the people, the work ethic, the customs, the culture, while obviously flawed in many ways, were still recognizably shaped by the Christian faith. Well, what happened after America won her independence? America began to expand westward, and you know the story. We began to take up either purchasing or conquering more and more land westward. And in the early 1800s, another form of revival broke out. This revival became known as the Second Great Awakening. In the Second Great Awakening, America developed its own Americanized form of Christian faith, one that broke away from the pattern of the historic church, including the Reformation. It's as if when we won our independence, we severed our ties with the old world and with tradition in more ways than were necessary. We broke with Europe, not just politically, but also ecclesiastically. Americans became very suspicious of anything older than their own nation. So let me give you an example here. If you grew up, particularly if you grew up in the South, okay, maybe not if you're, you know, if you're fairly young, but if you're older and you grew up in the South going to church, you probably experienced an altar call. An altar call. And you know how this goes. At the end of a church service, it would be every head bowed, all eyes closed. We're going to sing 15 verses of Just As I Am. And you would be called to the front of the church at the end of the service if you wanted to make a decision for Christ. Okay, I know that's familiar to some of you, to many of you probably. That is the legacy of the Second Great Awakening. For 1,800 years, the church had done without altar calls. For 1,800 years, the church had grown and expanded and even built a Christian civilization without altar calls. And then suddenly, the altar call became the way to do evangelism, the way to become a Christian. And while the altar call, considered in and of itself, might not be a huge problem, it was part of a whole new system of religion that did, in fact, have a lot of problems. The system of revivalism introduced in the Second Great Awakening went much further than the First Great Awakening in disrupting historic patterns of worship and church life. And that's what you need to see. Let me unpack some of the problems here. What George Whitefield was to the First Great Awakening, Charles Finney was to the Second Great Awakening. But there were some major differences. Whereas Whitefield was a Calvinist who believed in the sovereignty of God and the sovereign grace of God to work salvation, Finney rejected Calvinism. He believed that man's will was the decisive factor in salvation. So for Whitefield, revival was a free and sovereign outpouring of God's grace upon a people. Revival could not be conjured or controlled. It's all in God's hands. For Finney, revival was, this is how he defined it, revival was the right use of constituted means. Finney said, religion, and therefore revival, religion is the work of man. One of Finney's most famous sermons was entitled, Sinners Bound to Change Their Own Hearts. Okay, so hopefully you can see the problem with that sermon title. For Whitefield, revival was rooted in theology, specifically Calvinistic theology. For Finney, it was the product of technique. In other words, revival was more about psychology than theology. And so he invented what he called new measures designed to generate a response, designed to bring people to a decision point, to have that crisis conversion experience. He invented the altar call, measures like this. Think about it. If man's will is not enslaved by sin, as Finney thought, so the sinner can and must be persuaded to come to faith by human means, then using the right words, the right methods, and the right music becomes the key to evangelism. To put it crassly, evangelism becomes marketing. In the First Great Awakening, Lord's Day worship was still distinct from the revival meetings. In the Second Great Awakening, Lord's Day worship became a revival meeting. And it's all about trying to get people to make this decision. And so every service would end with this altar call. The First Great Awakening still encouraged reverence in worship, but the Second Great Awakening had a tendency to turn worship into entertainment and amusement. The First Great Awakening was still deeply doctrinal. The sermons were very biblical and theological. The Second Great Awakening was anti-intellectual and anti-doctrinal because doctrine just got in the way of trying to lead people into a conversion experience. So to give you an example of this, a revivalist preacher in Kentucky in the early 1800s was asked if he was a Calvinist. And he replied, "We are not personally acquainted with the writings of John Calvin, nor are we certain how much we agree with him, nor do we care." Okay, you see that? We don't know if we're Calvinists or not, and we don't even care. We don't care what John Calvin might have thought. The Second Great Awakening was theologically thin. The Second Great Awakening was highly individualistic and experience-centered. It was expected that conversions would happen more through emotion than reason. You know, the First Great Awakening did have an emphasis on a crisis conversion experience. I noted that and even its impact on covenant children. But the Second Great Awakening took that expectation of a crisis conversion experience to a whole new level. The crisis conversion experience became the defining mark of being a Christian. And the more of a crisis a person went through, the better. The First Great Awakening was still focused on discipleship. One time, Whitefield had preached in an area and there had been a tremendous response to his preaching. And he was asked by someone, how many conversions have there been? You know, in this most recent preaching that you've done, this amazing response we've seen, how many conversions have there been? And Whitefield said, "I don't know. We'll come back through in a year or two and find out." Whitefield understood that unless conversion resulted in a transformed life, bearing fruit and persevering in the faith, it was not a real conversion. And since you can't know that right away, you've got to wait and see. The Second Great Awakening was all about decisions, not discipleship. And so they would count decisions as conversions. They would count decisions as conversions. For many, discipleship became optional. You could have Jesus as your Savior without submitting to Him as your Lord. You are saved when you make a decision. In the theology of many of the Second Great Awakening revivalists, you're saved when you make a decision, no matter what you do afterwards. No matter how you live after making that decision, God is stuck with you. Even if there's no fruit or obedience in a person's life, the revivalist would assure you, you are saved. It was once saved, always saved. But salvation did not necessarily result in life change. Okay, many of you probably grew up with a form of Christian faith kind of like that. During the First Great Awakening, church order was still important. Pastors went through a training process, and educated ministry was valued, and that went along with the emphasis on doctrinal preaching. In the Second Great Awakening, all of that was gone. In the Second Great Awakening, men were sent out on preaching tours with their clothes still dripping wet from their baptisms. You know, you might be a brand new convert with no training at all, no adequate understanding of the Bible, but if you say you're called to preach, then you go. You know, you hit the preaching circuit as a revivalist. And this is how America went from being largely a Presbyterian and Anglican nation to largely a Baptist and Methodist nation in the 19th century. As America was expanding westward, expansion was happening faster than the older, more traditional churches could keep up. The Presbyterians certainly couldn't produce enough pastors to keep up with the growth of America, the movement of America westward. Think about it. If a man wanted to be a Presbyterian pastor in those days, he'd have to go to Princeton or some other seminary for 3 or 4 years. Then maybe he'd go off and do one more additional year of study in Europe before getting ordained in the Presbyterian church. Meanwhile, what do you think was happening on the frontier? The Baptists were planting churches with pastors who got converted at a revival meeting 3 months before. Now, who has time for theological education when there are souls that need saving? A revivalist named Peter Cartwright put it this way. He said, "Illiterate Methodist preachers are setting the world on fire while the Presbyterians can't even light a match." And that pretty much summed it up. The Great Awakening brought other changes. The Second Great Awakening brought other changes. The Second Great Awakening changed the church's liturgy and hymnody. The old hymns and especially psalms were considered too theological, too difficult, too deep. So they got replaced with simpler and more emotional songs, usually calculated to produce a conversion experience, at least some kind of emotional experience. And of course, that continues to be highly influential in the church down to our day, even though it's a totally novel thing in the history of the church. The church had always made the Psalter the backbone of her musical culture. The Psalms had always been at the heart of the church's singing. With the Second Great Awakening, that changes. Psalms are out, praise choruses are in. In fact, many now define religion or define worship almost totally in terms of feelings and experiences generated by music. If you ask them how church was today, the answer to that question is going to be based on how the music made them feel. That is completely the legacy of the Second Great Awakening. It's gotten more sophisticated, of course, than a lot of churches today. It's a rock concert with a light show. But all of this grows out of the way the Second Great Awakening completely changed what was expected to happen when Christians gathered on the Lord's Day. Long after the revivals of the early 19th century had died out, the Second Great Awakening continued to reshape and redefine how the Christian faith is practiced in America, and particularly what happens when Christians gather for worship. Figures like Billy Sunday, Dwight Moody, and Billy Graham carried forward the techniques of revivalism into the second half of the 19th century and into the 20th century. Billy Sunday is a rather interesting example. He had been a professional baseball player and then cashed in his celebrity as a traveling preacher. And I do mean cashed in. He went on the preaching circuit and he became a millionaire in the early 1900s when that was a lot of money. And towards the end of his preaching career, someone complained he was too rich and he said, "Look, I only got $2 per soul I saved." Okay, so like Finney, he was a pragmatist. He looked for techniques that worked in generating a response. He was famous for his often ridiculous gimmicks and antics and his humor as a preacher. He was not famous for his theological precision. And that's not to say that God didn't use Billy Sunday or others like him to really convert people. I have no doubt that God did, and that all of this was well-intentioned, and that God really used it in many ways. We know God can strike a straight line with a crooked stick anytime he wants to. But this was not the classical Protestantism that built America in the beginning. It was not the classic historic Christian faith that had built Western Christendom. The same could be said of Dwight Moody, another traveling revivalist. He was another great preacher, very famous for traveling all over. Once Dwight Moody was asked about his theology, and he said, "My theology? I didn't know I had any." Moody actually used a gospel tract that presented the way of salvation like a voting ballot. And on this gospel tract, it had boxes checked with an open box at the end. God has voted for your salvation. Satan has voted against your salvation. And now you get to cast the deciding vote. So you see, it is the will of man that is now sovereign in salvation. Salvation is reduced to a human decision. That's the legacy of the Second Great Awakening. A slogan coming out of the Second Great Awakening was "No creed but Christ." We're not going to confess the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, certainly not any of the other creeds. It's no creed but Christ. And that pretty much captures the way the Second Great Awakening hollowed out the theology of the historic church. In all of this, what stands out about the Second Great Awakening and its aftermath is how it rejected so much of the church's glorious liturgical, musical, and theological heritage. And it rejected them because all of that was considered dead tradition. Americans loved novelty. Many prided themselves in being know-nothings, that is, in being anti-intellectual. There was no interest in learning from the past or continuing on with the traditions of the church. Again, it was a uniquely American and very novel way of doing things. And of course, this kind of American desire to innovate, this American ingenuity, it has served us well in so many areas. This unique energy that America has as a youthful nation, it has served us well in so many ways. It has not served us well in the life of the church. It was thought that a new nation required a new form of Christian faith, and so there was a break with the past. The result of the Second Great Awakening is what some have called the juvenilization of American Christianity. And it was indeed juvenile in many ways. Everything had to be dumbed down. Everything had to be easy. It had to be entertaining and accessible. It had to be focused on me and my personal issues and my personal experience and my emotions. And given this and the desire to produce results in the form of decisions, it's like the flashier churches became, the better. The more anti-traditional and individualistic churches became, the better. The fewer demands a church makes, the better. If psalms and hymns are too hard, we'll sing praise choruses. If doctrine requires effort and study to understand, we'll put some movie clips in the sermon for you. If discipleship is too hard, well, you might miss out on heavenly rewards, but you'll still be saved because you walked an aisle, you hit the sawdust trail and responded to an altar call when you were 12, and so you're saved. You might miss out on reward if you don't pursue a life of discipleship, but you're saved. I might be exaggerating a little bit, and certainly some churches and some revivalists were better, but this is largely where things landed. In the early days of American history, the church shaped American culture. After the Second Great Awakening, American culture shaped the church. The church was more American than America was Christian. And so while the styles and techniques have changed over the years, the basic strategy has remained the same. Revivalism became the dominant form of American Christianity. The church got replaced by revival meetings and eventually the parachurch. Worship got replaced by evangelism, and evangelism became a form of marketing. Tradition got replaced by the novelty of constant reinvention, looking for the latest and greatest way to generate that response and gather a crowd. Doctrine got replaced by emotion. Discipleship got replaced by decisions. The perseverance of the saints got replaced by once saved, always saved. The psalms got replaced by praise choruses. Congregational singing got replaced by the praise band. The Lord's Supper got replaced by the altar call. Maturity in the life of the church got replaced by church as youth group. I mean, you go to a lot of churches today, and that's what church is. It feels like youth group. It's youth group all the time for everyone of all ages. Sermons that apply the Bible to all of life got replaced by the same simple message of salvation week after week. And so it's no wonder it stunted the growth of Christians. They weren't being taught the whole counsel of God. And the kind of bold, deep, and rooted public faith that produced Christendom, that produced Western civilization, got replaced by a privatized faith centered on the salvation of the individual. The Second Great Awakening replaced the culture-shaping, culture-transforming faith of the Reformers and the Puritans with a me and Jesus kind of faith. It's me and my Bible, it's me and Jesus, that's it. It's also important to understand that the Second Great Awakening had very different characteristics and went in very different directions in the North and the South. Now, that's not surprising. We're talking about the first part of the 19th century. The two regions were already growing apart in the first half of the 19th century, and of course then went to war with one another in the middle of the 19th century. In the wake of the Second Great Awakening, parts of the North became known as burned over districts, burned over areas, especially in New York. The waves of revivals burned people out and made them skeptical of the Christian faith, and in some cases, all religion. These constant waves of revivals made people skeptical about religion altogether. Several cults like Mormonism came out of this. But the main development in the North was churches turning to liberalism and the social gospel. The social gospel spawned feminism, egalitarianism, and socialism. That's the direction this went in the North. I won't go into all the reasons for that. If revivalism led churches into liberalism in the North, it led churches into irrelevance in the South. People still went to church in many cases. They still had real faith, but it was a shallow, privatized faith for the most part. Even as many Christians in the North became liberals, many Christians in the South became fundamentalists. And what are fundamentalists most known for? They are known for withdrawing from culture, dropping out of politics, and creating all kinds of hedges between themselves and the world, usually very legalistic hedges to keep the world out. But in doing that, they also prevented themselves from having any kind of influence in the world. This became known as the Great Retreat, Christians retreating from politics and culture. The Great Retreat really began even before the Civil War, and it actually continued up until very recently. In fact, it wasn't really until the Roe versus Wade decision in 1973 that Southern Christians began to awaken from their cultural and political slumber. When they started killing babies, a line had finally been crossed. And at least some Christians in the South and other parts of the country began to realize that if you take Christian culture for granted, you will lose it. If you don't defend what has been built, you will lose it. And many Christians began to realize we're in danger of losing this altogether. And so the beacons were lit, and many Christians have responded by saying, yes, there is this culture war going on, and we need to fight it. Thankfully, many Christians in the South and indeed throughout the country have begun to fight back. Now, how do we assess all of this? While the Christian faith built America, Christians have not been vigilant in defending what was built. The Christian faith played a hugely significant role in the formation of our nation. The Christian faith was not only for individuals, but it informed our culture and our politics and so forth. The kind of Christian faith that became predominant in the aftermath of revivalism, while in many cases still a real faith, has been of a different quality, and frankly, of a lesser quality than that faith that built America. Chicago pastor A.W. Tozer was once asked if he wanted to see revival. And he said, if revival means more of what we have now, then no, I don't want revival. He saw that something was deeply wrong with American Christianity. It's not that souls were not getting saved, but that the faith did not have the same effect in the world that it used to, that it once did. So what is the way forward? Well, there's a whole lot to say about this, but I'll give you one thought here. in part at least, the way forward is backward. In Jeremiah chapter 6, the prophet tells Israel, ask for the old paths and walk in them. They had departed from the old paths, the paths that God had given to them. And so Jeremiah comes to them and he says, ask for the old paths and walk in them. That's where you will find life. If the American church has abandoned patterns and traditions in liturgy and in the nurture of covenant children that were actually helpful and biblical, we need to recover those old ways. We need the old-time religion. And by old-time religion, I don't mean 19th century America, but more like 16th century Geneva. And really, in a way, that's what TPC is all about. Not so much revival, though we're happy for God to give that if it's real, but what are we really about? Reformation. It's about recovering what has been lost and building upon it. It's about a new reformation. It's about recovering these treasures, this glorious heritage that has been lost, and then building upon that. It's about the kind of faith that not only saves souls, but the kind of faith that builds Christendom. Not only the kind of faith that saves sinners from hell individually, but the kind of faith that can build a Christian culture, a Christian nation, a Christian civilization. That's what we desire, and to that end we work. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.